It's with the greatest pleasure that I welcome you to the second lecture of the Leon Panetta 2017 lecture series as we continue our discussion of the Trump presidency and its impact on the future of our nation. Tonight, we turn our focus to the economy. President Trump has the distinction of being the first president in American history to be elected without any prior government or military experience. However, he was largely elected because he recognized the anger and frustration of America's forgotten workers who believed that Washington was doing nothing to deal with their problems. They believed that President Trump would change that. Throughout the campaign and his first few months in office, President Trump has promised to bring a new, tough, boardroom-style approach to his leadership. He said he would renegotiate trade deals, protect and revive American industry, limit regulation, penalize companies who move manufacturing abroad, invest in infrastructure, simplify the tax code, and crack down on illegal immigration. But it is one thing to promise change in Washington, and as you know, it's quite another to deliver real change to the American people. The recent failure of the Republican health care bill has left many to wonder whether President Trump's talents in business can be successfully transferred to legislative and political success. Further, what are the long-term considerations of the new economic nationalism he and his team are promising and promoting? Can we have free trade that's also fair? What impact will new and more protectionary trade deals have on multinational corporations that produce goods in the United States, but do so with foreign-made components? Will restrictions on immigration result in more jobs for American workers, or will they harm those industries that rely on immigrant labor? Will we ever see the large-scale economic growth that followed World War II and created the vibrant middle class that defined the American dream? Where should we target investment? When is regulation necessary, and when does it overstep? What are the best policies for securing steady and long-term economic progress for all? Tonight, we'll talk about all these aspects of the economy with two experts who know these issues inside and out. Our first guest is one of the most high-profile business leaders in the nation. She started out as the secretary for a small real estate business before being recruited by Hewlett-Packard, where she would eventually become chairman and CEO. In that post, she led the reinvention of this legendary company, successfully steering it through the dot-com bust, saving jobs and fostering growth. Called the most powerful woman in business by Fortune magazine, she was the first woman to lead a Fortune 20 company. In 2010, she challenged Barbara Boxer, the incumbent U.S. Senator for California. 5 years later, she announced she would seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States. In this effort, she captured national attention as a non-establishment candidate with private sector experience and a platform of citizen government. She received her undergraduate degree from Stanford, her MBA from the University of Maryland, and her MS from MIT. Please welcome Carly Fiorina. Our second guest has served under three federal administrations and is one of the nation's leading thinkers about the economy. He is the former U.S. Secretary of Labor and a past member of President Barack Obama's Economic Transition Advisory Board. The author of 15 books, he has a reputation for seeing where politics and the economy are going before they get there. In his most recent book, the national bestseller, Saving Capitalism, he anticipates a widening political divide, not between Democrats and Republicans, but between establishment elites and anti-establishment populace in both parties. He is also the co-creator and host of the acclaimed 2013 documentary, Inequality for All, in which he explains the underlying forces shaping the economy. It lays out pragmatic solutions for a broader prosperity. In 2008, he was named one of the nation's top 10 thought leaders by the Wall Street Journal. He received a BA from Dartmouth College, an MS from Oxford University, and a JD from Yale Law School. Now, please welcome back Robert Reich.
Thank you again for being here. Thanks again.
And of course, moderating our discussion is the man who created this lecture series 20 years ago. From his service as chairman of the House Budget Committee to his time as director of the Office of Management and Budget and his experience negotiating the defense budget as Secretary of Defense, the economy is a subject he knows very well. Please welcome Leon Panetta. Love you.
Thank you. Good evening and welcome to the second forum of the Panetta Lecture Series. As you know, our theme is the Trump presidency and the future of America. Our first forum focused on the Affordable Care Act, whether it would be repealed or replaced, none of which took place. We have seen, obviously, the problems that are confronting the new administration as they try to put in place the agenda for the new president. Tonight, we talk about the economy. And there, obviously, there were commitments made with regards to the issue of tax reform, which is the next issue that the Congress will focus on. Issues related to jobs, the ability to produce jobs and protect jobs in America. Issues related to trade, renegotiating trade agreements, and issues related to immigration. A lot of issues that involve some very complex and tough challenges for the Congress and for the country. But I guess I would remind all of you that the fundamental issue here does rest with a group of forgotten Americans, those workers who lost their jobs, a lot of jobs lost in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, and a lot of anger and frustration by those forgotten workers who did not feel that either the economy or Washington were doing anything to try to help them in the challenges that they were confronting. And the result was they took that anger and frustration to the ballot box and voted for change and heard a lot of promises about the things that would be dealt with in order to try to meet their needs. But as H.L. Mencken once said, for every complex problem we face, there is a solution which is clear and simple and wrong. The challenge for us tonight is to talk about some of the simple promises that were made. What are the complexities here? And what are the chances that ultimately we will find solutions to those issues? And I've got two great and distinguished speakers with us to talk about the economy and about these challenges. Let me begin with framing kind of the general picture about our economy at this point, and ask, what do you think is the state of our economy? We obviously have had a stock market that now is in excess of 20,000 volume, and a lot of it based on the hope that the Trump agenda would be implemented. We've seen jobs increase. We've seen unemployment go down. We saw the Fed increase interest rates, obviously feeling that the economy was on a better track. My question to both of you is, where is our economy right now? Are we in a strong recovery, or is it likely we could go back into a recession at some point? Carly?
Well, first, let me just begin by saying I've been a fan of Leon Panetta's for a long time, and this kind of opportunity, seriously, to have a reasoned civil discussion about complicated issues is more important in our country than ever. And Bob and I have had a chance to debate in the past, usually on TV, never in person, and we agree on some things and disagree on some other things, but hopefully it's always an enlightening conversation. So thanks for having me here. I think, in brief, the economy is not as good as Obama said it was and not as bad as Trump says it is. Clearly, we have had a recovery. We've created millions of jobs. The economy is stronger now than it was. It's also clear, however, that the economy is underperforming its potential. I mean, 1.8, 1.9, 2% growth, that's not good enough for this nation. And it's equally true that the recovery has been very uneven and unequal. There are places that are doing just fine, like here in Monterey. And then there are communities, and I've been in too many of them, where there is a sense of hopelessness and powerlessness over their own lives. I don't think 6% growth is in the cards, but I do think we should be striving for closer to 4%. And I think we should be thinking about growth and opportunity as one of the most critical elements of what we have to worry about as a nation, because opportunity and growth can make a lot of problems better, and a lack of opportunity and growth makes everything worse.
Bob?
Well, let me also add my thanks to you, Leon, and to Sylvia for putting this on. This is your 20th year. And I've also had the privilege of working directly with Leon Panetta in the Clinton White House. And I can tell you from the bottom of my heart, there are very, very few people I've worked with who are as dedicated to the common good and the public good as Leon Panetta. So thank you for that. In terms of the economy, I think that we're obviously in a recovery. You ask, will it end? And the answer is, it always ends. Actually, it's going to end on September 14th. Nobody knows. That has not been down in the business cycle. I think the more important problem has to do with three long-term structural issues that we have not figured out how to deal with. Number one is basically that the median wage has not increased in over 35 years. There has been no increase adjusted for inflation. And that, I think, is very closely related to the frustration you've talked about, Leon. The second related problem is that more and more of the workforce is becoming less secure. It doesn't have a full-time job. It's working part-time or working in a contract relationship. And the third problem is that we've got a lot of people who are no longer in the workforce at all. The so-called, the labor participation rate is the official name for it, but it's lowest it's been in almost 35 years. And that means that people who are not in the workforce are too discouraged to look for work, or they are on disability, or we don't really know what's happened to them, mostly men, but it's a big and increasing problem.
Let me pick up on some of your points by asking something related to this whole issue of jobs and technology. We've seen an awful lot of jobs being lost, particularly in manufacturing. There's a real concern that because of new technological developments in robotics, in unmanned systems of one kind or another, obviously the whole data revolution on the cloud, et cetera, that because of what we've seen developed with microchips, et cetera, that the jobs of the future simply aren't going to be there because technology will replace many of those jobs. I guess my question is, as you look to the jobs of the future, are we in a different era in terms of technology permanently replacing jobs in the future? Or like innovations in the past, will we develop other jobs in high tech or energy to replace the jobs that have been lost? Bob?
Well, I think the big difference between the technological innovations we're seeing now and those over the last 1,000 years, all of which replaced jobs, but created a lot of new jobs, is that now the pace of technology and technological change is faster than our ability to adapt through education, job training, through all kinds of means. And so it's not that people are going to be losing jobs, but what's going to happen, and it's already started, is that the quality of the job that a lot of people have is going to decline. The safest part of the economy is in the personal service part of the economy, where people are basically giving what is essentially attention. Retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, childcare, elder care. These kinds of jobs are in abundance, and they will stay in abundance because they're not competing with machinery or with foreign workers. But they don't pay well. They're very low productivity jobs. And I worry, frankly, that we're going to have a problem, even with the median wage continuing to drop.
Carly?
I think we have to confront the realities and the requirements of the 21st century. The 21st century is different than any other century that has come before. Your smartphone, which is 10 years old, has changed everything. And the pace of technological change, to Bob's point, is not going to slow down. It's going to accelerate. The reality of that is that in such a climate, continuous innovation is key. That's the way we've solved every problem in this country. That's the way we have continued to advance as a nation, is through innovation. Innovation has certain requirements to it. One is an education system that prepares people for the challenge. A second is that we, I believe, as Americans, have to understand that in this age, any person can go anywhere, money can go anywhere, ideas can go anywhere, jobs can go anywhere. And there are people all over the world competing for jobs and ideas and money and talent. Our mindset has to be that as a nation, we will compete for every idea, for every brain, for every job, for every opportunity. And that's not the mindset that we bring to politics today. Many of the things that we do make it harder for us to compete for brains, or jobs, or money, or talent. The final thing that I would say is one of the realities, one of the requirements of the 21st century is to recognize what works. And I think in a very rapidly changing, fast-paced global economy, where everyone wants the same things, opportunity and ideas and money, we have to get real and understand that big bloated bureaucracies don't work very well. They are hierarchical, they're process intensive, they're top down. And so I think we have to be thoughtful, therefore, about which problems we give to the federal government, because the federal government is a big bloated bureaucracy. It doesn't make them bad people, but it's a bureaucracy. Innovation and risk-taking and creativity tend to happen better at a grassroots community-based level. That's why I believe in limited government, honestly. I think it works better in the 21st century.
Obviously, a lot of this is occurring now with a new president, and I can't resist asking this question since you ran for president of the United States.
And I want to say, once again, Carly, you would have been much better.
And I, you know, I don't know, why does that feel like damning with faint praise? I appreciate it.
So we've got a president who's approaching 100 days in office. And I think all of us, regardless of whether we're Republicans or Democrats, recognize that we've had a bumpy ride. Mm-hmm. You know, we first legislative priority was unsuccessful. A lot of effort, and still it didn't get anywhere. Wasn't even taken up on the House floor. The whole issue of this investigation, which is going on the Russian effort to influence our election, and what are the possible ties to the Trump administration. The fact that he's issued a lot of executive orders, but some of the more important ones have been blocked in the courts. The whole issue of these tweets and some of the things that have been part of those tweets that have gone out to the public. Clearly, you know, there's a lot of concern about the direction here. And I guess the question I would ask you is, you know, are we looking, is it too early to say we're looking at a failed presidency, or is there a chance that this guy who used to be in business will be able to get his act together and deal with these issues we're talking about?
Well, I think it's certainly too early to conclude that this is a failed presidency, but I think it's also fair to say some things have got to change. I mean, I am not a Twitter fan, and I don't think these tweets are helpful to anyone or anything. My guess is his staff has tried to take his Twitter account away, but I don't think it's going away. With regard to the Russia investigation, what I have said publicly as well as privately to my Republican colleagues over and over again is I believe it would serve the president, but more importantly, it would serve the nation to have an independent commission or a special prosecutor. We have got to get this out of the political sphere because no one trusts the answer. The American people need to be reassured about what happened. And I think we must pursue the facts and the truth wherever they lead. And unless, sadly, because we live in such a polarized partisan age right now, I think unless somehow that investigation is taken outside of the political process, not enough Americans will believe the outcome, whatever it turns out to be. With regard to health care, I was very disappointed, honestly, to see that Republicans were making exactly the same mistake that Democrats made. I think it was a mistake for Democrats to force on a single party, along single party lines, a major change in something that is so personal to each American, their health care. And the Republicans made exactly the same mistake. I'm disappointed that after 7 years of talking about repealing, there didn't seem to be a plan to replace. But I'm even more disappointed that Republicans somehow believe that it was okay to get something passed on purely partisan lines. Because in the end, especially when you're talking about somebody's life, you cannot get support for major change. And major change always inspires major resistance. It is the nature of change, and people voted for change. But you cannot get major change accomplished, particularly change that's personal, unless people understand that where they're going is going to be better than where they are. And there was never an attempt made to explain to the American people that where we're going is better than where we are. Nobody sold this plan. It's not even clear that the details of the plan were understood. We went through that with Obamacare. So to me, what the president ought to do now is slow down, take the time to build consensus and to build a plan that can get the majority of Americans to support it, because this bill had 17% approval when it was polled. The reason it was easy not to vote for it is because constituents were calling up and saying, what are you doing to my health care? I'm not convinced that where you're going is better than where I am, although I don't like where I am. So obviously things need to be different. I will also say this. In the end, we've been talking a lot about this today. It is the purpose and the goal of the Panetta Institute. But in the end, I think Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, as well as throughout the nation, are going to have to recognize that the only way we're going to solve these pressing problems is to find some common ground. And it has gotten to be a punishable offense in both parties. There seem to be purity tests going on in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I've negotiated a lot of deals in my life, and I know that a good deal, which is what a political compromise is, you need to understand what your principles are, what your walkaway position is, what you have to have. That isn't everything. And then you have to push everything else into the middle of the table and find common ground. And we need some people to step up and do that in Washington, in both parties.
Bob?
I think nobody wants a failed presidency. A failed presidency would be a huge, huge problem for the United States. But I think it's important to distinguish between two different fundamental challenges we face. One, Carly, you just pointed out. We've had gridlock between Democrats and Republicans now for many years.
Yep.
And it has become dysfunctional in the extreme in Washington. And I couldn't agree more that Democrats and Republicans have got to look beyond the party, look to the nation and the nation's good. So that's one challenge. But I think that there is a separate challenge right now, and that is Donald Trump. And I want to talk just briefly about that because, honestly, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, there is something that is not normal going on. And I say that this with a great deal of respect, but I'm concerned about our democratic institutions. When a president criticizes the press, demeans the press, criticizes the courts and judges who disagree with him, says that a former president wiretapped him without any evidence. And we could go on and on and on. The point is that I am concerned about the office of the presidency as it exists and as the institutions of the presidency are and our democracy exist. And I want to preserve them. Leon, you and Carla, you, in terms of running for office, and I, we all love this country. We all love and respect our governing institutions. We want to make them stronger. And I worry, frankly, about the temperament and the character of the person who's now in the presidency, not as a Democrat, not as a Republican, but as a citizen, I worry.
Bob, let me ask you something. You were Secretary of Labor. You've always been concerned about workers in this country. Obviously, President Trump found the pulse of America with regards to those workers that had lost their jobs and that really had a tremendous amount of anger and frustration about what was happening to them and just didn't think Washington was working or even both Republicans and Democrats were really concerned about them. But, you know, Democratic Party is the party of the workers, and yet somehow Democrats missed what was happening out there. Why did that happen?
I think it's not new. Democrats have not come up with the kind of solutions, working with Republicans, or sometimes working without Republicans, that really respond to the stagnation of wages. And you have so many people out there who have worked so hard and are playing by the rules and are frustrated and getting angrier and angrier. And so they respond to a self-described populist, and it wasn't just Donald Trump, it was also Bernie Sanders, a very different kind of populist. But a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now almost, I was out in red states, I was flogging my book, and I thought, why not try to flog it in red states, just to see if anybody responds? Nobody did. But what I heard was that a lot of people were saying to me, you know, I'm beginning to focus on the presidential election, and I'm considering, these were the same people, they said, I'm considering either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. And I'd say, how can you possibly? And they would tell me that they're just sick and tired of business as usual in Washington, and both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, although very different, they are just challenging the system. And I think that's what is going on. I think that we have a lot of people who just think the system is rigged against them. And that, until we unrig it, you asked what can Democrats, I think we can talk about solutions in a moment, but until the Democrats and Republicans really do get big money out of politics and make politics work for average people, we're gonna have a series of problems. It's not just Donald Trump. We're gonna have more and more of this kind of thing.
If I can just add, Gallup, the polling firm, has been asking two questions for almost 25 years. And the results in the last several years have been startling. 80% of the American people believe the federal government is incompetent and corrupt. Now, 80% means it's Republicans, Democrats, independents, young, old, men, women, people of every ethnicity. And 80% of the American people also believe that we have a professional political class that cares more about its own power, privilege, and position than on getting the people's work done. So when you have 80% of people feeling that way, yeah, they think the system isn't working. Yeah, the system isn't responding to their needs and their requirements. Part of unrigging the system, I think, is, and I think Bob's absolutely right, is we have to recognize what the system is. The system right now is big government, big business, and big money. It's a lot of complexity. It's a lot of bureaucracy. It's a lot of regulation. It's a lot of taxation. That complexity favors whom? Complexity always favors big companies over small companies. It favors wealthy individuals over not so wealthy individuals. It favors the connected and the powerful over the faceless and the anonymous. And so the very size and complexity of the system that we've created is in part why the system is no longer responding to the American people.
Let me ask a Let me turn your attention to another issue, which is this attack on free trade. Trade has been kind of one of the whipping boys for the loss of jobs. And frankly, both Republicans and Democrats had a tradition of supporting free trade agreements. Trump made clear that trade was responsible for a lot of lost jobs. It's undermined support for trade agreements in both parties. Really are not there. But the reality is that we're living in a global world. The reality is that our economy, whether you like it or not, is highly dependent on trade. We've had something like a trade surplus for manufactured goods of $230 billion. Farmers and ranchers have boosted their exports by 130%. 60% of U.S. imports are intermediate goods that go into U.S. products. How do you deal with the economic reality of the global world that we're a part of the need for trade to take place in order to protect our economy, and yet at the same time, this reaction that somehow these agreements are responsible for lost jobs? How do you find the balance there?
Well, I'm not a fan at all of Trump's trade policies. Something Bob and I agree on, it was Smoot-Hawley and the tariffs involved in Smoot-Hawley that made the Depression so much worse and longer lasting. We have to be part of the global trading community. In fact, one of the bright spots early on in this rather tepid recovery during the first Obama term was exports. So yes, trade creates jobs. And when we can compete, we win. Let's look at, for example, the technology industry, an industry I've spent most of my life in. The technology industry is the least regulated industry in the world. It is hyper-competitive. It is the most globally intensive competitive industry in the world, and yet American companies dominate it. Because when we can compete fair and square we can win. The problem is, so I think we need more free trade, not less. The problem is, I think we have negotiated, in some cases, agreements and then not held our partners to those agreements. I can remember the commitments that China made when they entered the WTO. The business community was very supportive of China's entry into the WTO. China made a number of very specific commitments. They have lived up to not a single one. And there has not been any consequence. No one has pursued that. NAFTA, I happen to think, was a good trade agreement, not a bad one. But not everyone has lived up to their agreements in NAFTA. The truth is the United States hasn't lived up to all of our agreements in NAFTA. But the truth also is that Mexico and Canada haven't. I happen to believe that fewer people negotiating is far more effective for American interests than too many people negotiating. I think it's just common sense. It's why I was against the TPP. You had too many parties negotiating for too long in secret. And so you didn't actually know what was going on, but guaranteed the big companies' lobbyists were making sure that their interests were protected. And so I think the more bilateral or relatively small multilaterals we can do in a transparent fashion, the better. I think tariffs need to be low, not high, but I think our trading partners have to be held to the agreements they make, and there have to be consequences when they do not stick to those agreements.
Bob? Well, I think the most important point here is that trade is not a zero-sum game in which one nation wins only to the extent that another nation loses. It's a win-win, and that's the way we have treated it up until very recently. In the post-war era, one of the reasons the United States became so prosperous is because other nations became prosperous. We actually created, and we were the engineer creating a worldwide trading system. So it worries me, this retreat. And trade is being blamed for things that trade is not responsible for. I mean, the job pressures today come more from technology and technological change than they do from trade. I think the best response, honestly, is to take the pressure and the target off of trade and focus on the things we ought to be doing, investing in education, in job training, in a re-employment system that increases the chances that if somebody loses a job, they can get a good job back. Infrastructure, that should have been the first thing that the Trump administration did. It was an easy one to get done. Why they took on repealing and replacing Obamacare first, I will never know. But these investments in people, investments in the workforce, are the way we have to go in order to ease the pressures on trade and all of the other targets like immigration, which are not responsible. They're simply fall guys.
You mentioned it. Let me ask about immigration, which is another one of the kind of whipping boys for lost jobs in America. President Trump has argued that immigrants, both legal and illegal, undercut wages, take jobs from native-born workers. But on the other hand, immigrants have been very important to the economy and have provided vital labor in agriculture, in the hospitality industry, in construction, and are important to our economy in those areas. I guess the question is, who's right here? Is immigration causing this loss of jobs, or are immigrants important to our economy?
Well, the correct answer, and this is not fake news, is that immigrants are critically important to our economy. They are usually in separate labor markets. That is, new immigrants are taking jobs that are not the kind of jobs that most Americans want, particularly immigrants from Latin America, Mexico, so forth. And as this nation ages, we are going to need more and more immigrants in order to maintain the proper ratio between retirees and workers. So overall, we really do need immigrants. We are a nation mostly of immigrants, and this kind of anti-immigrant scapegoating is very, very dangerous for the economy and dangerous for our society. Now, let me compliment you, Leon, because once again, you were there in Congress where we almost came to a a deal between Democrats and Republicans to regularize immigration, to deal with undocumented and unauthorized immigrants, put them back to the beginning of the line, but at least make it possible for them to become citizens, instead of what we have now is a dragnet that is incredibly inhumane. It is busting up families. A lot of dreamers, those young children who came here as infants, are also being caught up in this dragnet. And we are doing something that I think is uncharacteristic of the United States in terms of the cruelty that we are now imposing on a lot of people here in the United States.
Carly, I'm interested in your reaction as well, but you also, because you're from Silicon Valley, know that a lot of skilled people have been brought in on H-1 visas to help in that industry. Give me your sense of just how important that has been.
Well, first, I agree with virtually everything Bob Reich just said. This is a nation of immigrants. It has always been a nation of immigrants. Immigration makes us stronger. We must be a magnet for brains all over the world. That's how we compete. It's also true that politicians have let problems fester around the immigration system for years, for decades, and it has contributed to the frustration the American people feel. So, example, the H-1B visa program, which you're referencing, the H-1B visa program is incredibly valuable and important for technology companies. It has been artificially constrained by politicians for decades. I know, because I was up on the Hill saying, why are we doing this? Why do we have politicians picking numbers once a year? The H-2A program for farm workers in this country, in this state in particular, Democrat and Republican politicians have known the answer to this problem for at least 7 years. And yet that program has never been reformed. And so frustration builds up. We have 16 different visa programs in this country. We don't know when people have overstayed a visa. Some of these things are so fundamental. And yes, people worry about a porous border where anyone can come across. I don't know if you've been reading recently, but Canadians are now clamoring for increased border security. So when,
so they're building a wall.
So my point is, when we don't address festering problems, a lack of border security, when we don't reform and fix programs that we know are important and work, like H-2A and H-1B, when we don't fix a visa program, then frustration builds. The American people, I am convinced, want this problem solved. But they also, you know, one of the differences between business and politics or in your family life, if you have a big, complicated problem, you actually don't start by boiling the entire ocean at one time. You actually start by solving the problems you know how to solve and moving forward step by step. But that isn't how politicians have wanted to do it. They want to boil the ocean. Let's do everything at once, and then guess what? Nothing happens. So I think we could rebuild some confidence if we would tackle the things we know how to fix. We know how to fix the visa program. We know how to fix the employer verification program. We know how to fix H-2A. We know how to fix H-1B. We could have border security. No, don't build a wall, and Mexico won't pay for it. But we do need border security that the American people can count on. One last story, if I may. American people are compassionate. I support the DREAM Act. I mean, people's hearts break when families are torn apart. But on the other hand, I remember going to a little town in New Hampshire and meeting with a Democratic mayor and his wife. And this was in the summer when all of these women and children were flowing across the southern border illegally. And those women and children were being placed into communities around the country until we figured out what to do with them. And this woman, who was very compassionate and believed deeply in immigration, said, you know, my heart breaks for these kids, but we can't take care of the kids in our own community. How are we going to take care of these kids? There's some practical aspects to this that we have to be willing to face as well.
Before we go to the audience's questions, take a break here, let me at least touch on the issue of tax reform. Obviously, the focus now is on the potential to be able to pass tax reform. The last time we passed tax reform was over 30 years ago. It was when I was in Congress in the 1980s. And it took place during the Reagan administration, but both Republicans and Democrats dealt with that, and we were able to get it passed. Hasn't happened since. Why? Because there are lots of loopholes that are now in the IRS code, tax code. A lot of special interests that are out there who are fighting to oppose any elimination of any of those tax breaks. And a real kind of conflict about how do you simplify this tax system. So I guess what I would ask is, if you had, first of all, what are the chances that we're able to pass tax reform in this Congress, number one? And number two, just give me an idea about what you would focus on in order to really implement tax reform for the American people. Bob? Well,
first of all, the chances of tax reform in this Congress, I would say, generously, optimistically, 5%. But I say that partly because whenever you put the word reform next to a complicated subject, watch your wallets, because everybody has a different meaning of what tax reform actually entails. And if the Republicans can't even get together as Republicans over something they've been promising that is repealing and replacing Obamacare, well, you can bet the tax reform, whenever there is a tax bill in Congress, and Leon, you know this better than I do, every lobbyist for every company and every special interest group comes out of the woodwork to justify to their particular patrons they can deliver. And what's the easiest thing to deliver on? Some tax bill. And so it's like bees and or just hornets. I mean, they're just crazy. You have to go up to the hill when a tax bill is being debated, and you can't see anything for all that. So the only way around that is strong leadership. I mean, really strong leadership on both sides of the aisle. And I frankly don't see that, Leon. I wish I did. I think we do have to get rid of those loopholes. We've got to get rid of the special interests. How you kind of suggested, well, what would tax reform look like? I think that's what it looks like. It looks like getting rid of a lot of loopholes. But here again, your loophole is considered by me to be a right. I mean, look at the mortgage interest deduction. I mean, how many people here consider that a loophole? Put up your hand if you think that's a loophole. Well, actually, the mortgage interest deduction is a huge, quote-unquote, loophole in the sense that most of the benefits go to pretty wealthy people who can deduct big mortgages, the interest on big mortgages. And, you know, if you're poor or lower middle class or working class in this country, chances are you either rent or you're not going to get a big mortgage. Or we could go down all of the things we consider to be either loopholes or rights, and that's why it's so complicated.
Carly?
Well, I do think that in order to get tax reform done, and I think it's very much more difficult now than it was 40 days ago. Sadly, because there's actually bipartisan support for tax reform. I mean, Democrats and Republicans have been telling us this for almost a decade now. There's bipartisan support for tax reform, yet it never gets done for exactly the reasons Bob is suggesting. I do think there are some basic things, perhaps, that could get done. I mean, we could conclude that it is uncompetitive to have the highest business tax rate in the world, which we do today. That's not helping us compete for jobs. We could conclude that we need to bring trillions of dollars back in cash that's just parked out there overseas because we can't figure out the rate to tax it at. We could decide some of those things. But ultimately, it is the complexity of the tax code that's crushing, that's killing. 76,000 pages filled with loopholes. Who does that benefit? The wealthy and the big, not the struggling and the small. I think we need a different mindset. I don't hold out a lot of hope for this.
Higher than 5%?
Well, but to the point of requiring leadership, and requiring courage, maybe even the courage to say, I might not get reelected. I mean, we have politicians who want to be reelected at all levels of government and both parties. That's their most important objective, to get reelected. Maybe that shouldn't be the most important objective, but boy, I'd sure love to have people approach this problem with a different mindset. And instead of saying, our job is to protect all the loopholes, to just start with a basic proposition. Lower every rate, close every loophole. Lower every rate, close every loophole. And put the burden of proof on the people who think a loophole needs to exist. Because right now, all of the burden of proof is on the people who want it to go away. And that colors the debate in the way that Bob just suggested. But to do that, to change the mindset and say, lower every rate, close every loophole, boy, it's gotta be a really good case to put a loophole back in. Two or three is a lot different than 3,000 of them. We'll take courage and leadership, and I'm not sure we see a lot of that in D.C.
Okay, we're going to be turning to your questions from the audience, but first let me recognize the question review team, people that actually select the questions that will be presented to our speakers. And I ask you to hold your applause while I introduce all of them. Fran Gaver, who's our veteran question review team member, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter from KAZU Radio, Claudia Melendez-Salinas, who's a staff writer for the Monterey Herald, and Peter Weversky, who is an executive editor of the Salinas California. If you would give them. We have a group of students that are with us this evening who came out of the afternoon student program. I'd like to ask all of the students in attendance to please stand and remain standing until I recognize each of the schools present. If you would all rise, please. There are five schools that are represented tonight. These students are from the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey Peninsula College. And we also have students from Santa Clara University. Thank you all for being here. We had a great turnout this afternoon. We had about 400 students. It was a great program. They loved to ask questions of our speakers. And Sylvia and I and the board of the Panetta Institute are very, very grateful for the sponsorship that allows those students from high schools, colleges, universities, our military installations, all of them from throughout the Central Coast to participate. So if you would give our sponsors a great hand, too.